evening. I'm Kilo 2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You will also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to organize a thing called the Technical Net. We gather this group of enthusiastic guys each Sunday night at 8 o'clock. It usually lasts until midnight, sometimes beyond. And we discuss our favorite subject. Electronics, wireless electronics in particular, ham radio, and all the kinds of gadgetry that gets connected to it. Any subject of interest to an electronic enthusiast, computer enthusiast, is appropriate for this Technical Net. Tonight we're probably going to be doing a little bit of talking about a nice article that was brought to my attention by Lou NY2H, which is in the Sunday issue of Newsday, page Echo 5. It's about who invented a car radio. Apparently Motorola had a lot to do with that. We're also going to be discussing a very nice set of articles I found on a website from a man named William Beatty, the University of Washington. And he's got a brand new slant on the way you explain how electrons flow and what is electrostatic electricity versus electrodynamic electricity. They're really the same thing, but people separate them in funny ways. So he's got a different slant on doing things. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After 27 and a half years, by now we sort of believe that there are people out there listening. The net has lasted that long. So you need not sign in if you're just listening. We sort of accept that by now. There's enough people in the tri-state area that this particular repeater covers, which is northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, most of Long Island, and south.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And southwestern Connecticut. And you're supposed to interrupt every minute and a half of talking so you don't time out the machine like I just did. Don't do what I did. Make sure you remember to, when it gets passed to you, wait until you hear a beep to reset the timer and try to remember to interrupt your speech every minute and a half. Okay, at this time we're going to take in check-ins. A person who signs into the TechNet would sound like this, N2XJN, Wesley. And yes, Wesley's already checked in. I heard him earlier. And he's in the process of making some kind of change to his transmitter. It's a little bit noisy on the input. So give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
W-H-O-R-Y. Jeff. One question, two comments.
K2KDY, can I say something, Dick, before we start?
Hey, go right ahead, Mel. We're going to try to stop the whole proceeding at 9 o'clock to go over to your mailbag. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Got a number of phone calls, number of emails that we are not picking up with number of people with the questions. We've got the pause, wait for people that are coming in either via an echo link or one of the other modes. And also, please pick up all the questions before 10 o'clock, and then if you want to go back and discuss something else in detail, okay, they want to, you know, stay with us. But the number of people said that they called in, they acknowledged it, but they never got to it. They had to give up. It was too late. So can we just pick up all the questions first? It's over.
Yeah, I think we're going to interrupt our questions and answers by 9 o'clock to pick up the mailbag for the younger people. I think you're saying we should try to get to all questions by 10 o'clock. If a person signs into the Technical Net and we don't get to him that particular week for a whole bunch of reasons, that makes him automatically number one the very next week. So signing in and not getting handled is not a disaster. There is a bit of a recovery there. We picked up Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, on that last check-in. There was another person who was checking in, and I missed his call letters. Who was that?
N2EO.
It's November. Where's he at?
Yeah, we got Rich and Wesley, but who was the other person?
KZ2MDP, Steve.
Yeah, Steve. Steve, I heard, was number two. Wesley, number one. Joe, number three. And Rich, number four, in that order. And some guy named Mel also signed in. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time. I think that was AF2TT Rich. Very, very weak signal, but he said he had no questions. Okay, let's start off with Wesley first. How are things going there, Wesley? With that great big laboratory that's being assembled in Queens, N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, another device on its way, special analyzer from 100 Hz to 8 GHz color stream. That's what I have. And I have two questions. One of the questions is, I believe some, not many, but some of the ham radio operators might be confused about the issues of resonance. And what do we expect from the components of the resonance circuit and how that these components behave? For example, the L inductance, Q quality factor, RDC, which is the winding resistance, Z impedance, and phase angle. There's another factor, the transform ratio of inductance. In other words, if we have a resonance, then the inductance is the highest or is the lowest. The Q is the highest, the lowest, this kind of stuff. Let me jump. And how is the capacitor in series and parallel circuits behaving also? The difference between series resonance circuit and parallel resonance circuit, I believe that's very important information for ham radio operators. The second question is, how would you use the spectrum analyzer, and what would you do to use spectrum analyzer as network analyzer? Back to you, Dick, and to you.
Very fine, Wesley. Just before Wesley picked up, I heard another person attempting to sign in, possibly by one of the other modes that are more delayed, a Whiskey 1. We're going to give a nice long delay, and who was the other person trying to sign in? And give me a call letter, the name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW listening.
Papa.
Okay, I heard something like Whiskey 2 Papa, but a signal that was heavily distorted. I really can't make that one out. I heard something like Whiskey 2 Papa, but as I said, very heavy distortion, as if it was off frequency, but I know that that's not what it is. I think it's an internet method of sign-in. Anyone else? Give me your call letters at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WHYY, just want to comment. I believe I checked in first this week, and I'm not sure, but I'm listening to duplex. I don't know how you put me number 3 on the list, Dick.
Okay. There was some kind of a delay by the time you came through.
I don't think so. Someone high band.
You're going to be number 2. Hang in there, Joe. Wesley, I'm listening to you on the input. Your signal is nice and loud and nice and clear. When it comes through the repeater, it is quite weak, distorted, and there's some other squiggly sounds in there. So apparently there was some form of unusual propagation taking place again tonight. And we can understand what you're saying, but just let you know that there's quite a bit of excess noise coming through the machine, but it's not present on your signal itself. If your antenna was capable of being aimed in any other direction, it would probably make a difference. I think there's a kind of a multipath going on. Alrighty, Wesley's main question was on the subject of resonance. Let me drop it. And when it comes to electronic circuits, resonance is extremely important. Essentially, none of the antennas that we use will function without a phenomenon called resonance. I'm going to try to define that in a minute. So every antenna you have ever used, with rare exception, those two exceptions I know of are a rhombic antenna and a beverage antenna. Those two antennas are a zillion wavelengths long. But for any reasonable antenna that we build, which is usually a half wavelength or so in its major dimension, resonance is required. You resonate the antenna first before it will radiate. After 35 years of studying antennas, after collecting about 35 books, I finally found a respected textbook that said those words. It was in the craziest of all places. It was a military field manual for temporary radio setups for the Marine Corps. They tell people that when you take random lengths of wire and reconstruct an antenna that's just been damaged in order to get military communication on HF frequencies, you must resonate the antenna first before it will resonate, before it will radiate. What is resonance? In the case of an antenna, and the way it's explained in that field manual for the Marine Corps, the charge of energy coming out of your transmission line enters the bottom of the antenna. They're talking about a vertical wire antenna in this case. Let me drop. And that charge of energy coming out of the transmission line, created by your transmitter, travels down the wire of the antenna, comes to the upper end where there's an open circuit, without phase reversal. In other words, it keeps its polarity. That signal then reflects back down. If the trip up the wire and back down the wire to the feed point happens to be a quarter wavelength in time on the way up, a quarter wavelength in time on the way down, half wavelength total, that means the signal is capable of bouncing back and forth in a reinforcing manner. And that's what resonance really does. In every resonating circuit, energy of some form, whether it be magnetic energy in the case of an inductor, stored electrostatic energy in the case of a capacitor, or when it comes to just the length of a wire with its distributed inductance and capacitance effect and the time delay you get in the wire, in either case, energy is bouncing back and forth and staying in step, and therefore the individual steps reinforce each other. In the case of a parallel inductor and capacitor, where you're literally putting the capacitor across the ends of the inductor, at resonance, when you measure the impedance of that circuit, the impedance is extremely high. You may be using an inductor that's got 100 ohms of inductive reactance, and at this particular frequency, the capacitor reactance is also 100 ohms. That's another way of defining resonance, by the way. When the capacitor and the inductor have the exact same amount of reactance. Reactance is really the impedance it presents to a radio signal. If you apply the formula 1 over 2 pi square root of LC, that's one definition of resonance. Reactance is 1 over 2 pi x...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Capacitor reactance is 1 over 2 pi FC. F is frequency in hertz, C is capacitance in farad. Multiply those two together, multiply by 2 pi, take 1 over. That number you get left with is the number of ohms of capacitor reactance. Inductive reactance is 2 pi FL. 2 pi times frequency in hertz times L, inductance in Henry. And again, you come up with some number of ohms. When the capacitive reactance at this frequency equals the inductive reactance at this frequency, and you put that capacitor and that inductor together, you have a resonance circuit. Put them together in parallel, and that resonance makes the composite impedance become very high. I may be, in my example I used before, using a capacitor with a reactance of 100 ohms, an inductor with a reactance of 100 ohms at this frequency. I put them together. You would think you're going to get 200 ohm things in parallel. Yeah. But one's got a leading phase angle. That's the capacitor. One's got a lagging phase angle. That's the inductor. You put them together. You don't get 100 ohms or 50 ohms or 200 ohms, multiples of 100. You get thousands and thousands of ohms. They almost cancel each other when they're in parallel. Craziness, but that's the way it works. Let me drop. Put that inductor and that capacitor, the exact same one, instead of putting them in parallel, put them in series. Again, the reactance cancels, but this cancels in the other direction. Now the new impedance of that circuit goes toward 0 ohms. You've got 100 ohms of capacitor reactance in series with 100 ohms of inductive reactance. Because they're in series, you're now going to measure an overall impedance or reactance, whichever you want to measure, of something that in many cases is a fraction of 1 ohm. So you can see the magic of this. If, for instance, I have a transmission line which has a second harmonic, I'm transmitting on the 40 meter band, I'm on 7.1 megacycles, and something is not working right with my transmitter, it's putting out a lot of second harmonic. Second harmonic of 7.1 megacycles would be 14.2. And the guys on the 20 meter band, 14 megacycle band, are complaining that I'm in two places at once and I'm interfering with them. And I'm listening in one and talking on one, but they're getting interference on the other, and they tell me about it. Or I get an FCC official observer report or whatever. So I got second harmonic. If I choose an inductor and a capacitor that have a resonance at 14.2 megacycles, I put those two things in series so that now they present 0 ohms at that one frequency, and I put that across my transmission line. Doesn't matter if it's coax cable, twin lead, or whatever. I put that series LC network tuned to 14.2 megacycles across my transmission line. Let me drop. It presents something close to 0 ohms of impedance only at that frequency. Now my second harmonic that used to be coming out of my transmitter, going down that transmission line, sees that short circuit at that frequency and can't propagate beyond that point. I've stopped the 14.2 megacycle, second harmonic energy, from getting to my antenna in this example. This is simplistic, but it shows you the principle of operation. In reality, there's much better kinds of filters I could use there. A bandpass filter at 7.1 megacycles, a low-pass filter running below 10 megacycles. There's all kinds of filters I could use to get rid of the second harmonic, but that shows you one possible operation. Another thing I could do back at the transmitter to try to emphasize the 7.1 megacycles and reject everything else is to create another LC network and put the inductor and capacitor in parallel with each other, put that across the transmission line. It presents an open circuit essentially only at that one frequency, 7.1 megacycles. So I could be operating simultaneously with a parallel LC tuned to 7.1 megacycles, passing that frequency out of my transmitter. I could have a series LC shunting out 14.2, the second harmonic, put that also on the transmission line. I've now made a kind of bandpass filter at 7.1, band stop filter at 14.2, by just using an L and a C. So inductors and capacitors combined as a parallel or series network. Very important when it comes to antennas. Let me drop. Antennas, transmission lines, getting rid of undesired frequency, allowing desired frequencies. Where they get used the most, you study the schematic diagram of your receiver or your transmitter. Let's talk about the receiver. Your receiver right now is tuned to the 7.1 megacycle band, the 40 meter band. You've got a good antenna connected to it. And the front end network on that receiver is a bandpass filter allowing 7.1 megacycles and adjacent frequencies to come through. So there's a LC network, probably parallel, at the front end of the receiver before the first RF amplifier, if there is one, allowing those frequencies to come through because it's a parallel LC. And maybe it's maybe there's another network there of a series LC at 14.2 to make sure the second harmonic coming down the antenna doesn't get into the receiver when the receiver is tuned to a 7.1. So you study the schematic diagram of your receiver and your transmitter, you're going to see lots of times where a parallel LC network resonating at that frequency is allowed to act as a bandpass filter for the RF amplifier. There's another one on the IF amplifier. There's probably something similar to it on the audio circuitry, limiting what frequencies come out of the loudspeaker. So studying the way resonance takes place, and in the case of an L and C network, let me drop. Previously I told you that in the case of an antenna, when the energy propagates back and forth on the antenna, and you need this propagation back and forth on the antenna because radio radiation from an antenna is nowhere near as easy as you think. When that signal first passes down the wire, about 5% of the energy jumps off the wire, energy jumps off the wire and goes into space. 95% is left over. By allowing resonance to take place, because you've carefully chosen either the length of the wire or the way you've impedance matched the wire with your antenna tuner, you force resonance to take place, the energy bounces back and forth in a supporting manner, in a co-phase manner. That means either all of those bounces of energy are all in step with each other. In the case of a parallel LC network, during the time that the voltage is maximum on the capacitor, you've got a certain amount of stored energy there. That stored energy, if you want to rate it in the units of joules, it fits the formula 1/2 CV squared. Voltage squared times capacitance, take 1/2 of it. That's the number of joules of stored energy in your capacitor. If you know the voltage on the capacitor and the number of farads of the capacitor at this time, that tells you how many stored joules of energy is there. And on the first half cycle of this LC parallel network, when the voltage is maximum, most of the stored energy is in the capacitor. A quarter of a cycle later, that voltage has been flowing through the inductor. The current in the inductor builds up, and now as the LC network has its sine wave of voltage across it, as that sine wave goes through zero, at that instant of time, believe it or not, the current flowing through the inductor is maximum. Now all of the stored energy is in the inductor. None of it's in the capacitor. 1/2 CV squared. V is zero. So there's no...
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
There's no stored energy in the capacitor at the instant, but there's some number of amperes of current flowing in the inductor. And how much energy is stored there? 1/2 LI squared. 1/2 inductance in Henry times current in amperes. And the answer is joules of stored energy. So you can see in a parallel LC network, the energy is bouncing back and forth on each quarter cycle, in phase and out of phase, between each half cycle. And it goes through a complete cycle every 360 degrees, every period, one over the frequency. And you can calculate the frequency of a LC network by 1 over 2 pi square root of LC, L in Henry's and C in farads, or you can go to the appropriate chart in the early chapters of the antenna engineering handbook or the radio amateurs handbook. They've got the so-called reactance charts. You can find out what combination of inductors and capacitors will hit resonance at your favorite frequency by going to those charts. Let me drop.
The inductor should be the biggest and quasi factor the biggest in resonance.
Didn't understand that question, but let me proceed with what I was about to say. The inductive reactance and the capacitive reactance will equal each other at the resonant frequency. And now you can choose the size inductor and the size capacitor that hits resonance. In other words, if you've got a particular inductor you want to use, you think it's appropriate for this frequency, and what size capacitor is required to hit resonance, those charts or that formula will tell you. You've got another choice. You rapidly recognize the fact that there's a large number of combinations of inductor and capacitor that'll hit resonance. If my particular favorite frequency requires 1 nanohenry of inductance and 100 picofarad of capacitance, that might be my favorite resonant frequency. If I want to, I can half the inductance and double the capacitance, and I'll hit the exact same resonant frequency again. Instead of 1 nanohenry, I use 0.5 nanohenry. Instead of using 100 picofarad, I use 200 picofarad. I'll hit resonance again. The next question somebody's going to ask is, how do I know which combination is the best one? And now there's a number of variables involved. For each individual frequency range, there is an ideal size inductor. You're not going to use a 50 henry inductor at 100 megacycles. A 50 henry inductor might be very appropriate to be used as the filter choke in a power supply running at 60 hertz. So a 5 henry or a 50 henry, a henry is a big number. And at 60 hertz, you might likely use that. At 1,000 megacycles, you're more likely to use a nanohenry, 10 to the minus 9, a billionth of a henry. That's what a nanohenry is. It's smaller than a microhenry.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
think on the way the inductor is designed, depending on what frequency you're operating at, there are ideal size inductors. You've got to worry about the fact that every inductor has a self-resonant frequency. There's some stray capacitance between the turns. And so without even putting a capacitor across the inductor, as you go high enough in frequency, it'll hit resonance all by itself. That might not be a desirable method of operation, but that's something that does happen. Now, every real inductor has got some amount of resistance in series with it, because you can't build one with absolutely 0 ohms. Every real capacitor has got some amount of equivalent series resistance on its leads, and some equivalent series capacitance across its plates, if there's a real dielectric material inside. It's got a little bit of leakage resistance. So every inductor and every capacitor and every resistor you and I can pick up has got some other factors to it. Every resistor has got some stray inductance on its leads and some stray capacitance across the body of its resistor. Every inductor has got some stray resistance. Every capacitor has got some stray resistance. The next step in understanding is that once you make the formulas a little bit more complicated, and you really include the equivalent series resistor of the capacitor, the equivalent series resistor of the inductor, all by itself, the inductor and capacitor, you would think have one single resonant frequency, and you'd like to believe they have no response anywhere else. Well, because of the undesired resistance that's left and over on each one of those, you end up with some kind of finite Q. What is Q? Q is a kind of quality factor. If you were able to buy an inductor with nearly 0 ohms of series resistance, and if you can buy a capacitor with nearly 0 ohms of equivalent series resistance, and you put them together as either a parallel or series resonator combination, the Q factor, the quality would be very high. That means the tuning characteristic would be very narrow. So every real circuit has got some kind of finite Q, unloaded Q of just the L and C. But rarely do you use a resonating circuit all by itself. Most likely you're going to connect it to an antenna, you're going to connect it to an amplifier, and the way you connect it to the amplifier or antenna has another factor. Let me drop. That's a so-called loading factor. I can decide to tap my antenna one turn up from ground on that inductor, and that's the way I'm taking the antenna signal and coupling it into that inductor. The bottom of the inductor is grounded. One turn up, I connect the antenna lead from the transmission line. The top of the inductor, I connect the capacitor back to ground. And that's the beginning of putting my tuning network on the antenna and coupling the signal from the antenna into that parallel resonator in my combination. But if my antenna is a 50-ohm impedance, I have just placed a 50-ohm resistor across that first turn of the inductor. I've now created a brand new resonant characteristic of a slightly lower Q. That's the loading factor, the loaded Q. And how much insertion loss I'm going to get out of that network is a function of its unloaded Q to loaded Q ratio. As I tap down further and further toward ground on that input network from the antenna, I get a sharper and sharper tuning of the filter network. It runs at a higher and higher Q. I'm doing less and less loading, but now I have more insertion loss. As I tap further up on the coil, I'm coupling more of the signal from the antenna into the inductor. I get less insertion loss of that filter network, but now I've loaded it more, and I've made its bandwidth more broad. This formula is explaining this. So there's a kind of a compromise going on whenever you design a filter network, and some of that compromise is called unloaded Q versus loaded Q ratio. That determines what bandwidth you're going to get and what insertion loss, and there's a compromise between the two. If you want minimum insertion loss, you're going to be getting higher bandwidth, wider bandwidth. If you want very narrow tuning, you're going to get more insertion loss. And that's it pays you money, it takes your choice. That's the compromise that's part.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's part of the engineering that goes on. When it comes to measuring these inductor, capacitor, filter networks, and similar things, amplifiers and antennas and whatever. An extremely handy instrument, modern day instrument that does that, is called a vector network analyzer. All that really is a very fancy receiver with a very fancy signal generator. The signal generator usually has a frequency synthesizer. The signal generator steps through some series of frequencies that you tell it to. I might care about this network that I'm measuring. I'm trying to optimize its performance at 7.1 megacycles. I might set the network analyzer to scan from 6 to 10 megacycles so that I can see the in-band and out-of-band characteristics. Or I might set it to scan from 1 megacycle to 20 megacycles. I want to see the subharmonic response, the second harmonic response, and so on. So I tell the vector network analyzer what is the start frequency and what is the stop frequency. It sequentially applies those frequencies to the network. Let me drop. The vector network analyzer then looks at what voltage appears across your network and what phase angle is the voltage. The vector network analyzer, the word vector means it's not only measuring amplitude, but it's measuring phase angle. It's starting off with a rather precise signal generator, a frequency synthesized signal generator. That's built into the box. That's the excitation to the circuit under test. It's got another set of networks in the vector network analyzer looking at the response. It looks at what voltage and what phase angle is the response when that signal generator is attempting to apply a 50-ohm characteristic signal generator signal into your unknown network. Therefore, he's going to display for you amplitude versus frequency. That's the so-called XY chart. You can ask for that chart to be in voltage or in decibels. Or the handiest chart that network analyzer will display for you is a Smith chart, which is a kind of a polar display. There's a circle on the center of the screen. Let me drop. A dot in the center of the screen represents 0 volts. The outer circle represents unity, 1.0 volts. In other words, if your network presented a perfect open circuit so that you attempt to apply 1 volt to it and your network responds with exactly 1 volt, that voltage would be a line drawn from the center, a dot drawn from the center out toward the perimeter. It would go all the way out to the perimeter. If there was no phase angle on that voltage, it would be a dot on the far right-hand side of the screen on the outer circle. If your network acted as a perfect short circuit, then the energy you send down the transmission line to your network measurement would reverse in phase when it hits the short circuit. It would come back equal magnitude, 180 degrees out of phase, and it would be a dot on the far left-hand side of the Smith chart, or the polar plot. They have very strong similarity. So where the dots and lines represent on that Smith chart or polar plot, as you sweep across those frequencies, and maybe there's frequency markers on the screen, looking at the amplitude and phase angle, that's what that polar chart is telling you. And it's sweeping in frequency, so it's giving you a swept diagram of amplitude and phase, and a smart person looking at the chart will recognize immediately what does a parallel LC network look like, what does a series LC network look like, what does a dipole antenna look like, what does a loop antenna look like. They all have a very characteristic shape on that Smith chart display on the screen of your vector network analyzer. They're a little bit expensive. There's been a couple of articles in QEX magazine, among other places, as to how to homebrew a vector network analyzer. Let me drop. A smart guy taking a modern-day radio transmitter, which usually has a frequency synthesizer, and you can sweep it, if it's a ham radio only rig, you can easily sweep it from 14.0 to 14.5 megacycles, and it's frequency synthesized. So you could, if you've got enough computer smarts, you could program your ordinary exciter stage of your currently owned transceiver to sweep across that frequency range. And with a little bit of smarts, you could design a kind of oscilloscope looking at the response of your circuit, and you could homebrew a vector network analyzer. I didn't say it's easy. As I said, there's been some articles in QEX as to how to do it. But a vector network analyzer is the modern-day equivalent of a RC, what they call it, LCR. It used to be called LCR meter. Well, the LCR meter would give you a Dawson bowel movement, and you have to do some interpreting. A modern-day vector network analyzer is quite a bit more modern than an LCR meter. It gives you this beautiful oscilloscope display, sometimes in multiple colors, and a smart person learning how to read that display gets a tremendous amount of information in seconds as to how well that network is working, how well that antenna is working, how well that transmission line is working, how well the combination is working. And so testing an amplifier, a transmission line, an antenna, testing either of those in the forward direction, the reverse direction, LC networks, and so on, vector network analyzer, very, very handy. I'll give one further word now as to the difference between it and a spectrum analyzer. Let me drop.
They go on, Dick. Getting late.
Okay. Guess we got to stop. That's as much as we can cover tonight, Wesley. I know we haven't covered all of your questions. N2XJN, K2RIW, and the TechMan.
Valuable information and address there. I was just putting into the files everything that I know compared to everything that I've heard, and yes, I believe this is very...
Two, meter, transmit.
And the question is, when we have a time later on, is how do you use the spectrum analyzer as a network analyzer? What is it that you do? And there is another one, which is impedance analyzer with phase. So that's the questions if we have a time later on. Thank you very much, Dick. That's right there.
Okay, I heard a triple, but I heard a little bit of Howie. Howie, what were you saying?
Question, because I spoke to Mel on the radio today. I have a quick question on a subject from last week. Can I ask that question? Pick me up as soon as possible. I just have a quick question on the antenna you were discussing last week from QEX, please.
Okay, Howie, you're on the list. Joe, WA2RYY, go right ahead with your question, Joe. And I think you signed in last week. I'm not sure we got to you. You got it, Joe.
Yeah, I actually signed in first this week. I'm not sure how you put me number three and number two. But anyway, I have two comments and one question. I'll give the question first. I've looked on the internet, and I haven't really been able to find anything that really gives you any kind of, detecting solution as far as detecting power surges. We all use surge arrestors on our equipment, electronics, various types of electronics, and you really don't know when nothing's blown out or they do take a hit. Are you aware of anybody that makes something like that that was able to register a power line transient of an excessive voltage enough to make the surge arrestor react to it, but let you tell you that, okay, I've taken a hit, or sometime during a period of time, I've registered a hit on, coming in on your power lines. You know anything about that? If anybody makes something like that?
Howie.
Yeah, I think so, Joe. They make quite a few instruments that will give you a continuous recording of what the power line is doing in magnitude versus time. Those recording instruments, you can set them up in such a way that you set a particular threshold if it's monitoring the 120-volt line, and it will record all the incidents where the voltage went beyond, let's say, 127 volts on the high side and less than 105 volts on the low side. You can set the thresholds, record all those incidents, play them back, and then find out at what period of time you got what transient on your line. That's one approach. Yes, these transorbs and other kinds of surge arrestors that many people put on their computers, they help a lot, but there's a catch. And the catch is a transorb will absorb a high voltage spike, but only for a finite number of times. If, for instance, you live in Gainesville, Florida, the lightning capital of the world, let me drop, the lightning capital of the world, what you've got to do is to make sure that you recognize the fact that your transorb type surge arrestor has to be replaced every month or so, because there's going to be some number of hits of lightning coming down your power line, where the transorb eats away a little bit of its material on each occasion, and eventually the thing becomes a complete blown open circuit. And yes, it takes a pretty elaborate test procedure to find out what is the health of your particular transorb spike arresting network that you're using on your computer today. The guys in Gainesville know that they've got to change their
voltage arresting network every month or so, and they know they're going to be replacing their computer every year or so. There is one other solution, and that is the ferro-resonant type constant voltage transformer. The nice thing about that is that it does a beautiful job of absorbing the surge, not allowing any of it to go beyond into your computer, and it does not wear out. As long as you didn't get such a direct hit that it blows out the primary winding or blows out the resonating oil-filled capacitor inside, one of those constant voltage ferro-resonant type transformers, the people who make the extra investment to buy one of those for their computer claim that they last forever, and you almost never lose a computer unless somebody has put a great big spike on your internet line going in. If you've got a fiber optic line going in, there are people claiming that that combination lasts forever. So that may help a little bit, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
WJ2B.
Yeah, I was talking about more of a simple type of circuit or a device. Not something like a recording device where you're going to sit there and analyze it. Something which you may be able to either set, or maybe it's preset or pre-made, where say it tells you at 400 volts, 500 volts, 600 volts, some sort of transient occurred at that kind of voltage, just to let you know that something did happen, and it probably would be a good idea to change some of your power surge arresters. That's what I was basically talking about. That's not an elaborate site to set up.
UJL.
UJL recognized, but before that it was WJ2B. Joe, WJ2B, what would you like to answer this?
Yeah, I just want to make sure we get into repeater okay for us to be okay.
You're getting in fine. Go right ahead.
Interject a couple of things. I used to work for Amprobe Instruments, and they used to make a whole line of recording devices to measure power line transients. And they're very expensive, Joe. So probably the least expensive way you could monitor your power line, which is not going to catch very fast transients, but will catch a fairly long within the time constant of the averaging circuit in the meter, is to buy yourself a digital multimeter that has a min-max function on it that you can probably pick up for about maybe $60 to $70 and leave it, make up an AC line plug to banana jacks and put that into your multimeter. Leave it on the max function, and I don't know, you might have to disable the auto power off some way, though, depending if you can disable the auto shut off, but that would probably be the least expensive, is with a DMM of some type, even that, or a benchtop DMM that has a max function on it. But the recording devices, they might be cheaper microprocessor-based modules you can buy now that are hooked up to your computer, but a typical SAC surge spike recorder, which you're looking for, used to run about $800 from Amprobe. I don't know how much they're going for now, but that was quite a few years ago, so I just want to give you that comment there and see. You can probably search the internet for, like, SAG search spike recording equipment. You can find something. WJ2B.
All right.
KC2,
QNQ with a comment.
Okay. We've got Glenn Wesley, but before that, we've got UJL with a comment. Thank you for that information, Joe. Mr. UJL, give me your full call and your name, and then proceed with your comment, sir. K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Richard, I'll call you. How's that? Richard, I'm going to tell you something. I listen to you all the time, in spite of the fact this has nothing to do with what you're talking about. I find you immensely intelligent. You are, to me, it's a fascinating hour, 2 hours of listening. God bless you, and let me tell you, my name is Tony, KC2UJL. I'm becoming a member of the club. It's because of you. Listening to all of the intelligence and all the good information you're putting on this repeat. God bless you, my son. I'm out.
And that sounds like a very heartfelt compliment. Be careful, though. Like everybody else, I've got a certain batting average, and on a couple occasions I've made some beautiful big errors. Like, I gave people a whole lot of information where I thought I was, traceable to the Bureau. And occasionally I make mistakes. I'm willing to admit that, though. And by the way, another guy I've run into recently, where you guys would get a lot of information out of, how does electronics really work? At the molecular level, what are those electrons really doing? How many of them are there? How fast do they move? You might want to go to this beautiful website by William J. Beatty, B-E-A-T-Y. which he claims, if you read his philosophy, which is the beginning of all this great information he's got on his particular website, he literally says, I'm looking forward to the day when people point out the errors that I'm making. I'm not just a guy with such a great big chunk of pride that I'm always trying to defend myself. Interesting philosophy. You go to http://, don't put in any WWs. It's American Scientist is the abbreviation, but he abbreviates it to amasci.com/me.html. I'll repeat that. So http://alphamikealphasierracharlieindia.com/mikeecho.html. That's the beginning of his website, of this guy William J. Beatty. Interesting character. And so, boy, does he have a very nice explanation about all of the errors that are in the electronics books being used at the high school level today.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So there's lots of errors that Bill Beatty, William Beatty, is indicating. And, Charlie, I recommend you go there. You'll enjoy it. Glad you're enjoying the TechNet. But, as I said, be careful. I make some mistakes. And what has happened in the past is somebody will listen to me for 6 months. They think everything I say, because I try to say it with some kind of crazy authority, they think it's got to be accurate. Now, eventually they'll find a mistake, and their life and their world comes crashing down. How could that possibly be? So be careful. Alrighty, thank you, Tony. I'll see the other next person who's going to sign in with... Wesley was next, N2XJN. Go right ahead with your comment. After that comes Glenn. You got it, Wesley.
This is a device from the company called Drantes, D-R-A-E-T. It's a series of 808, and it's a power-on-demand analyzer. Now, this device, don't worry that it costs $400 or $2,000. You can get it for $50 on eBay. I saw it many times, and it does have a printer that you can put it online, and long time, you don't have to show up for quite a few weeks, and it will give you all of the information of what's going on. It does have a termination modules, which is the clamp-on power modules for 600 volts, and it gives you all of the cabling and extra rolls, everything is there. Usually when they sell, they sell it with the rolls. So this is a device that I recommend, and it's working beautifully. I tried it a long time ago when it first came out. That was 20 years ago. It's still good, and it's really inexpensive. But
thank you, Wesley. Sounds like a good lead, and maybe Joe can consider that. Glenn, you've worked with all kinds of crazy power circuits, particularly on the light-emitting, super-efficient diodes, light-emitting diodes that you work with. What's your least expensive way of monitoring the spikes, over-voltages and under-voltages? I can tell that Joe is looking for a method that's not going to break his pocketbook, and yet he'd like to protect himself and know when it occurs. KC2QIQ, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Vic. Good evening to everybody on the net. But I have a kind of a really couple of nickel solution for just determining what an overvoltage or a surge spike. It's not going to determine a droop, but it'll definitely determine a spike. And this is something I kind of came up with on my own when I was living down in Florida. And I was having all kinds of surge problems with power down there and tried to prove it to the power company. And the solution that I came up with was the cheapest form of instrumentation I could come up with was selecting some spark gaps. They're actually little electronic devices that you could put across a power line. But what I did was I selected a few of them that were like, 275-volt version, a 150-volt version, and then, like a 1,000-volt. And I put them in series with 250-volt fuses that were very, very small. They were only, I think they were quarter amp. And I just wired them in series with the spark gap and let it sit there on the power line. And when I'd come home from work every day after a lightning storm or whatever, I'd go check out these fuses occasionally and find out which one's open, and then look at the rating of the little spark gaps that opened those fuses, and I had a pretty good indication of how big a surge was actually on that power line, Dick. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
K2KEY, we're coming.
Mel recognized. Hey, that's a cute idea you got there, Mel. I mean, Glenn. The Polyphaser Company in Nevada, I think it is, makes all kinds of surge arrestors and whatever. Is that the brand name of these little spark gap closed glass modules that you were using with your quarter amp fuse as a method of detecting when a spike occurred? Where did you buy these spark gaps? How big? How much current were they rated for? How many dollars? Give us a couple of words on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I think you can get them at DigiKey today. At the time, I might have gotten them from Newark. And I think they're, I don't know, maybe 80 cents a piece, something in that order. And the fuses are, you know, about the same. So you can get a little box of corner amp fuses. But I would use at least the 250-volt glass versions because they're nice because you can see them when they're open, you know. And the other thing, too, is just to, you know, unplug it and then just check it with an ohmmeter to see which fuses are open. It's a very, very good little indicator. And I think if you took, like, a little piece of vector board and put a couple of these devices on it the way I did, I think I used, like, five of them. And I found out most of the searches were happening at relatively low voltages. I think one time it actually took out, like, all four up to, like, 1 kV. But then again, that was Florida power. And when I showed, actually, the one of the technicians from FPL, Florida Power and Light, I think they were a little bit more surprised, but they had to check. And what it wound up that they had to do was they were having an arcing problem up on the telephone pole, and they had to replace the insulators. And the insulators were actually arcing and causing the surges. And they came down the block. They replaced all the insulators. I guess they were getting some salt intrusion into them, and they were leaking and arcing over. And then the problem went away, Dick. It was amazing stuff, but that was how I figured out. And it was, I don't think I spent $5 in parts there, including the vector board. But back to you, Dick.
WJ2B, what happened?
JTB, J2B, we're going to get you after Mel. And you'd be amazed how many people are receiving radio interference, particularly even at cell sites, where a particular sector of a cell site will experience a whole lot of interference from arcing over insulators, particularly if you're near a seashore and salt gets on them. And right after a rainstorm, when they get washed, things get a lot cleaner. The noise goes away for a while and eventually builds up again. So arcing insulators are certainly something to make a spike out of an arcing insulator, though that's a really serious spike. You must have been somewhat close to a seashore is my guess. Mel, I'd like to believe you don't get great big surges of power, but you live pretty close to a seashore, so you quite possibly do. What have you done to measure? What have you done to protect yourself? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Okay, first of all, as far as the chart recorder, if you're interested in them, cheap. They were used extensively for many years in the refrigeration business, commercial refrigerators, so that they had a chart, a 24-hour paper chart that was slowly turning, and the air flow just a meter movement with a pencil on the end. Pretty sensitive, those meters, because many of them were 1 mil movement. 0 to 1 mil. And you can get them. I've seen them a lot of times downtown. They had a lot of them. In fact, I had one playing around here for quite a while. You can most likely easily make that into a monitoring source of some sort if you want to look at the line, say, for 24 hours. Let me drop in. I'll tell you one solution that I use is in the shack. I have a very big variac. Because the variac is actually an auto transformer design, the back EMS of the variac has a good tendency to absorb the spike. You have the spike duration many times, and it's very brief. So the variac with the back EMF will absorb it to a great extent. That's just an old-time solution, Dick, using a variac. And please, almost 9 o'clock, let's go on, over.
Yeah, roughly how expensive are these refrigerator-type chart recorders that you believe were available then, might still be available now? On the surplus market, what might I pay for one of those today? Best guess, Mel, go ahead.
To get down to New York where they sell all the commercial refrigerators for restaurants and things like that, And they may have one with a bunch of, you know, glass with a crack in it, or one the case is a little less, but the movement is still good. They may be able to pick it up for a few bucks. They may even say, you know, whatever. I've seen them literally for $5. I think I paid, yes, in fact, I paid it at a junk shop $5 for a takeover.
That's a nice number. Joe, WJ2B, what would you like to add to this for Joe, W2RYY, to not spend a lot of money but get the recording he's looking for? You got it, Joe, JTB.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I just wanted to add a little comment about Glenn QIQ solution from some things that I saw when I was working at Amprobe. I just want to say that the spark gap is a nice, you know, a nice...